State University of New York at Albany, and a leading author and researcher on cannabinoids and health, who pins the Ask Dr. Mitch column for High Times magazine.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Time for our cannabis Q&A with Dr. Mitch. And Dr. Mitch, how are you doing today?
I'm freezing my ass off. How you doing?
It's been pretty cold up there in the Northeast. We hope you got to keep yourself warm up there. Our question lines are open. We've got two different chat rooms now because we're on YouTube as well. So I'm watching both YouTube and the cannabis radio stream. And my apologies to the listeners out there who I pushed the wrong mute, and they were on mute there for the commercial break. But we do have a question. That's such a new setup, Dr. Mitch. I got so many buttons and stuff to push. Oh, my God. But anyway, we had a question.
I need that button for faculty meeting.
There we go. We have a question already, though, coming from one of the chat rooms that wants to ask, can we finally acknowledge that CBD equals hemp as far as when it comes to the Controlled Substances Act, when it comes to regulating it, that it should be treated like hemp? Is that something that you see on the horizon?
I mean, that makes perfect sense to me, but unfortunately, CBD is still a cannabinoid and unfortunately gets confused with psychoactive marijuana and thus ends up part of that Schedule I mishmash. I know that there are websites saying we're legal in all 50 states, but unfortunately that's really not the case. I think it should be the case, but I think THC should be legal in all 50 states, so maybe I'm not the guy to ask.
All right. And it doesn't look like we'll get any favorable movement in the right direction under this administration. It looked like Obama's administration was kind of moving that way, but we're just getting a lot of drug war rhetoric out of the Trump administration. What are your feelings on what you've seen so far in these first 3 weeks?
Given how much random stuff has happened, I'm trying to be prepared for anything, but I don't see Jeff Sessions suddenly saying, hey, CBD sounds good to me, just feel free to put it in the mail.
Yeah, I don't think so either. All right, let's take a look at some of the studies and surveys that have come across the desk here over the past week. One of these, I got this information through Michael Kravitz, who works with Veterans for Medical Cannabis Access, and he was pointing out how they were trying to add post-traumatic stress to Colorado's medical marijuana law, and how the people from Project SAM were using this new study out of Yale University that supposedly says that there are worse outcomes for PTSD patients who use cannabis medically to treat those symptoms. I know it's not never been your number one go-to as far as PTSD goes, but what do we make of this study?
Well, so unfortunately, it's more complicated than they're pretending. What's really happened here is there's a subset of folks who are at the VA trying to get treatment for PTSD, and they're having a really hard time, and what a surprise, Russ. The ones who are having the hardest time are the ones who end up turning to cannabis. So I'm afraid this isn't a sign that cannabis is making PTSD worse so much as it is a sign that folks with the worst PTSD may be turning to cannabis. I unfortunately am in a weird situation because I have a client right now who's a vet who's really good about showing up to exposure sessions without smoking anything during the daytime, but he does use cannabis at night to help him sleep, and he's doing great right now. I feel like the overextension of cannabis as a cure-all has been a problem, but also this wicked dichotomizing about cannabis being completely inappropriate is also incorrect as well.
We have a call coming in on our phone lines, but I don't know that I can pick this one up and keep you on the line, so I'm going to have to decline it for now. I haven't worked out that kink, and I'm not quite ready to, I don't think. Let's go on to our next study here, which it's not really a study. It's more your thoughts on what we've seen out of a couple of studies recently. We've seen the decline in the teen use of just about all drugs, alcohol, and cigarettes. And I'm just wondering, what are the factors that lead kids to want to try or not try drugs? What is leading to this decline? Is it the legalization of marijuana, or are there other factors involved?
Well, so what's funny is before anybody even had, medical cannabis on the books, there were some standard predictors of use, and it was almost always availability and perceived harm. And I think what we thought was going to happen is, oh, more and more people will have access to cannabis. People will see that it's not very harmful for adults. And unfortunately, then the teens are going to jump in there and we're going to all be in trouble. Oh, no. In fact, teens have been surprising us with their intelligence and their ability to make sense of data. And I think the fact that we are saying, hey, there are definite medical uses for cannabis has improved our credibility. So then when we have, you know, Stacey Gruber or somebody like that say, you know what, maybe teen use isn't such a great idea. Check out these brain structure data on the folks who start using heavily early in life. They're listening and they're saying, okay, we'll wait it out. It'll be okay. And there's something about taking away that rebellious forbidden fruit quality of it that I think may be helping out.
So when cannabis becomes like mom and dad's Chardonnay, it's just not as exciting anymore.
Sad but true.
All right. Let's take a look at this story that was appeared on weednews.co about the access to marijuana leading to less use of alcohol and pills. This is referencing some data from that Ease, the marijuana delivery service in California. But we've seen this as far as opioids go. But is this a trend now to extend broader into alcohol and drugs in general?
Well, so we've seen it go both ways with alcohol, and some large economics data sets have gone both that alcohol increases with medical availability and that alcohol decreases. I'm not sure exactly how this crew gathered their data. So this is sort of the delivery service gang that basically can make it so you can get marijuana to your house in California. I can't imagine they really have any reason to make this up one way or another. It certainly makes sense to me that hard drug use would drop when you've got cannabis available, particularly given the quality of cannabis we have now. And we have seen these really impressive decreases in opiate-related overdoses from that 2014 JAMA study we talked about before. So I've got to admit this is certainly consistent with other stuff we've seen, and I hope it really will replicate.
There could be some worry that if it does replicate, we might get more opposition from pharmaceutical and alcohol industries when we try to legalize elsewhere.
Well, I know they hate the truth, but we're just going to have to hope it wins out.
That's right. All right. There was a study that came out from UC Davis on California medical marijuana that showed there were some molds, there was some contamination on these products. And California, while they're working on their testing standards and getting that up to par, they're not there yet. Of course, consumers in unregulated states have no chance of it being a tested product. So what can consumers out there do to protect themselves from tainted marijuana? What are some of the signs? What are some of the warning signs?
I mean, I hate to say it, the thing we really need to do is legalize, regulate, and test. But in the meanwhile, if you smell some crazy mold or see some fungus on there, obviously you don't want to use that. By all means, if you're at a dispensary, ask them, hey, do you guys test for these kinds of things? And if they can't give you a straight answer, try to find another dispensary. When I was literally in college, everybody said, heat your oven up to 200 degrees, spread your cannabis out on a tray, put it in there, turn the oven off, and wait it out, sort of like the way we've been talking about decarboxylating, and that was supposed to kill bacteria and fungus. I've been on Google Scholar basically for the last hour since you sent me this link, and I think that may have just been an urban legend, so I honestly don't know if that's true or not. I got to admit, we relied on it quite a bit back in the 80s.
If you do have a bad bud that's got some bud rot or mold or fungus, I mean, can you pick parts of it off and still, you know, like you do with a cheese that's got mold on it, you just cut the little mold part off, the rest of it's all right. Can you do that with cannabis?
Sadly, it's unlikely, because if there's a concentration that you can actually see, odds are high there's a comparable one that you can't see somewhere in that same bag. I mean, the thought of throwing away pot, I know, is really hard on some of our listeners, but as inexpensive as the underground market has gotten, I really feel like it's just not worth the risk.
Okay. And Let's go on to this next study, because this is something, you know, we've talked about glioma, a form of brain cancer, in the past, and now it looks as though we're getting some studies in showing that these cannabis oil treatments are helping patients with this type of brain cancer. What is the latest on this?
So this was done by GW Pharmaceuticals. I do not own that stock anymore, so I don't feel like I have to do my usual cautions about that. I can say that they've been super good about cannabis-oriented sprays, and they're essentially getting a longer survival for this group that has a THC-CBD combination than the placebo group. And it's, you know, it's 550 days versus 369 days. I realize it's not like they're even living twice as long or anything like that. But when you're at the end of life like this, I feel like every day really counts. And I always talk about effect sizes interpreted with the dependent variable. And when the dependent variable is literally death, I would say this is some compelling evidence, despite the small sample size and what we usually think of as a small effect.
Okay, and our final study to look at today has to do with youth and their use of cannabis, and it says that if they wait until age 17, it may help protect their developing brains. We've always heard the brains developing until age 25. Is this rolling back that age, or is this something different?
It just turns out this is sort of a first step towards that, and if you can wait to 25, I think there are advantages that this data set simply could not address. But the line at 18 we've had from those old data on gray and white matter, again, Stacy Gruper's lab has shown some comparable things. You definitely don't want heavy use early in life, and the later you wait to try, the better things really turn out. This study in particular, you also are noticing some of the deficits are on the sort of IQ tests that go with stuff you should have learned in school. So I'm afraid some of these were kids who may have been high at school and just never really encoded some information that I think of as important that I'm afraid your average person doesn't. And I want to emphasize, this is at University of Montreal. This is a new data set. This is not just rehashing some of the old stuff that we've talked about before. So these are French-speaking kids. It's not the Boston data or the stuff we've seen from Peter Fried in the past. So I really do feel like the message to wait is one that we can say with some real relevance.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Mitch, and we'll speak to you again next Monday.
All right, man. Looking forward to it.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.